Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is so delicious, so unbelievable, no word exists to describe it. It's better than mind-blowing, it's mouth-blowing. Bright, citrusy, and spicy, this newest flavor from Captain Morgan is a balanced blend of sweetness with delicious notes of lime and slightly spicy chili flavor that is great for an escape outdoors with your crew or your next hangout. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is best enjoyed as an ice-cold shot or as a chili lime twist on a classic as a spicy daiquiri. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, a touch of sweet, a kick of heat. Please drink responsibly. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, premium Caribbean rum with natural flavors, 35% alcohol by volume, Captain Morgan Rum Co., New York, New York.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall. With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is so delicious, so unbelievable, no word exists to describe it. It's better than mind-blowing, it's mouth-blowing. Bright, citrusy, and spicy, this newest flavor from Captain Morgan is a balanced blend of sweetness with delicious notes of lime and slightly spicy chili flavor that is great for an escape outdoors with your crew or your next hangout. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is best enjoyed as an ice-cold shot or as a chili lime twist on a classic as a spicy daiquiri. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, a touch of sweet, a kick of heat. Please drink responsibly. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, premium Caribbean rum with natural flavors, 35% alcohol by volume, Captain Morgan Rum Co., New York, New York.
There's a whole fleet of them. Look on the ASA. My gosh. They're all going against the wind.
It was basically a cube with inside of sphere where the points of the cube were touching outside of the sphere.
So this isn't anything that just is limited to the United States. It's a worldwide phenomenon.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. We are into February, and I have on with me for his what must be third or fourth appearance now, investigative journalist and co-founder of The Debrief, which is one of the best websites out there in terms of not just UFO news, but science and all that kind of good stuff as well. I've got Tim McMillan. Tim, welcome back to the podcast.
It is a pleasure to be here, Andy. Yeah, it is. I forget. It is the third or fourth time. I don't know. It's always good chatting with you, you know, but I remember early on we got a chance to chat when you first launched this thing. And so it's fun to keep coming back, as you, especially as you've grown things up, man. It's fun to have watched this show.
No, thanks. I think that was the end of May or early June 2020. You were my fifth guest. So, yeah.
It was fun, man. No, I could tell then this was going to be a fun show. So it's a pleasure to be back and always good to chat. Hopefully we'll get some good stuff out.
Yes, there's a lot to talk about, and this was one that I've spent a bit of time on, taking a lot of really good stuff out as well, I think, not just in terms of listener questions and topics, but just we couldn't cover everything in the time we've got. So I want to get right into it, Tim. Listen, we keep hearing that since maybe October, November, December through to this year, we're in a down period for the topic of UFOs and UAPs. For an investigative journalist like yourself, what has this quote-unquote down period been like?
Oh, man, that's a good question. And I think it probably hasn't been nearly as maybe anxious as it is for a lot of people who follow the topic really intimately. And I completely am sympathetic with people who are, you know, these lulls where there's no information coming out. They're like, what the heck is going on? You know, it could get frustrating. I guess, fortunately for me, UFOs are not something that I've always solely focused on. You know, in addition to running everything with the debrief and making sure that's going on, and that takes a lot of work, you know, trying to start up an online news company. But my interest in general have always branched out. And in fact, my interest in national security defense type areas is what you could say worked in reverse. That's what the fact when they started talking about UFOs is when my interest really grabbed hold and I started, you know, pursuing it from a journalism standpoint. And so in these kind of lull periods, it hasn't felt like a lull period for me, primarily because, and I think people who follow me on Twitter have probably seen it. You know, there's been a lot going on in the world of geopolitics and defense. You've got a lot going on in Ukraine right now. So I've still been very active and focused on stuff. It just, in addition to the fact of working with stuff with UFOs as well. And I guess intermixed with all of that, you could also say there's never a UFO lull period for me either, because I've always got something going on, but from the product that's coming out, I can see how people see that. But it's kind of how I'll work on stuff for a year before an article comes out, but you try to make it complete. But there's constant work for me behind the scenes, I'll say that much. So it hasn't felt like a lull.
No, and it's not to myself either. I think Dan and I have discussed this on a few of the breakdowns that I thought would have went really quiet for a while, but there's still been a lot of good interviews out there. I mean, Jim Semivan's just done a good one on Coast to Coast. Colm Kelleher and George Knapp were just on with Theories of Everything last night. Kurt Giamungo, I'm wearing his hoodie just now, so thanks to Kurt. I mean, I did pay for it, so, you know, he can thank me as well. and also, you've got Chris Mellon releasing articles through The Debrief, which we'll talk about in a little while as well. So there's a lot to still get your teeth into. And if you look through, it's not been a quiet period. I want to get an early listener question in because it fits in here from Pleasure Man, what a name on Twitter. He said the subject of UFO, UAP is still, after so many years, not proven to be something extraordinary in terms of its origin. Basically, it can still be a lot of misidentifications. What's driving Tim to invest the time he has and does into the subject still? And I suppose that might touch on what you just mentioned about it. You can work on an article for a year before it even comes out.
Sure. No, I saw that when you put that on Twitter asking for listener questions. And I saw that when I thought, man, that was a great question. I'm glad that made it because it is an interesting question, because you're absolutely right. Or what was it? Pleasure Man. You're absolutely right. It's very understandable that a lot of people who would spend significant time on this topic, you get frustrated after a while because you reach this wall. And I think if you're going to maintain a true air of legitimacy by it, where the standard of what is fact is evidence-based, you reach this wall where you start and finish the same. You're like, I still don't know. and that's frustrating. I think for the topic itself, what keeps me motivated and continues my interest in it isn't for the same reasons that maybe a lot of people follow the subject, for this idea that there's going to be a disclosure, or this idea that we're going to reveal, you know, some sort of secret that's going to really change the course of human history. Maybe that will happen. I think that's awesome. I would love that. But at the same time, there's so many other variables of the UFO topic that I find fascinating. Aside from just the idea of what are these objects, what are people seeing, but it goes into, you know, how do we solve complex problems? You know, I've always been very interested in that. I pay a lot of attention to, it's part of the reason, besides just having an interest in the defense world, in how would the defense world solve a complex problem like this? I think it's much more complex than people realize, just based on all sorts of bureaucratic nuances and just junk in the system. It's not something that the system is inherently set up to establish. And then even on that side, in the defense world side, it's a very fascinating problem to look at from just policy and political science. You look at it from, I do that, and a lot of the people that I talk to is, this is a problem that requires a whole of government approach. And especially the U.S. government, you know, that's the government system that I'm most versed in. It's not something they're really well equipped to do. And I think that's interesting. And at the same time, I think there's some, I don't want to make it sound more, put more gravity into it than maybe it really is. But at the same time, it is significant. There is kind of this moral obligation to the idea that even if it's not UFOs, there can always be something that comes up. We've seen this with the pandemic, where you need a whole of government approach. You need, you know, specific to UFOs, you need the DOD to work with the FBI or the Department of Energy, or some of them that aren't even defense or law enforcement agencies. So your science-based agencies like NASA or NOAA, you need all these people to work together. And this is not something that they do. And I don't think people realize that. They're very separate entities. And so that in itself is fascinating. How do you solve a complex problem in a bureaucratic institution like this in government? And then at the same time, there's this mystery out there. And I think that's compelling. You know, I think that's why it lingers out there. I think it's kind of a catch-22 mystery, because a part of me wants to solve that mystery and absolutely would if I could. You know, if I got the big reveal, no doubts, I would tell the world. But at the same time, it's always once the mystery's gone, there's no more mystery. You know, anybody remembers the movie Seven with Brad Pitt when they, you know, he opens up the box, but they never show you what's in the box. Like, what's in the box? You know, all these things where, you know, movies or book leave you with this cliffhanger and where you have a mystery, because it can then be whatever it is to you. There's something alluring about a mystery as long as it exists. So I think as long as there is a mystery, as frustrating as it is for me, I think I'll keep chasing it just for that thrill of chasing a mystery. And I would encourage people to do the same. I think a lot of people get burnt out, frustrated. A lot of antagonism goes on because I think they're trying to really get to that goal line. But at the end of the day, I don't know that any of us know what that goal line looks like anyway. It might not look like what they think anyway.
Yeah, and it's like I like the movie reference. I always think Tarantino in Pulp Fiction, they open the gold briefcase. And it's what's in the briefcase? Is it someone's soul? Is it gold? Is it this? Is it that? And there's all these incredible theories that link the movies together. But if you really, really found out, you would have been, okay, it would have been the thing and that's it. And there's not that conversation and debate that happens around it. I think that the beauty, though, of this subject is, let's say, for example, one of these fast walkers, you wrote a great article on that some time ago, we find out it's extraterrestrial. That's not the end of the mystery, is it? Because, okay, where are they from? Why are they here? How long have they been here? What's the tech? You know, are there more of them? If there was no one inside, who's controlling them? I think it's one of those just incredible spider diagrams going back to school where you've just got all these bubbles and lines coming off of each other, having that debate and discussion around it.
Sure. Yeah, no, it truly is. And I know, when I've interviewed scientists who work on some of the techno-signatures hunting stuff, so not necessarily specific to UFOs, but there's a big push now, and we've seen with the launch of the James Webb, where we're continuing to push out further into space, and we're increasingly become more sophisticated in our ability to potentially detect biological or technological life that exists out there. And, you know, I always ask them, I was like, did you ever stop and consider, you know, for some of these people who have spent their entire careers, gotten PhDs about this hunt for extraterrestrial life? It's pretty much accepted that there has to be intelligent life out there. And therefore, that probably means they're looking too, if they haven't gotten here. So this is interesting idea. Do you ever think that you're out there with the big telescope peering out there, and at the same time, there is other intelligent life doing the same, perhaps peering back at us, perhaps trying to likewise develop the technology, or as a lot of people think when it comes to UFOs, they're already, have already mastered that. So I think there's an incredibly interesting dynamic of it, and you're absolutely right. There's perhaps an endless number of mysteries that are associated with this, and that process of trying to solve it is interesting.
Well, for the moment, keeping things a little bit more terrestrial, you mentioned that compartmentalization in the US government particularly, which happens in all governments. And I want to get your thoughts on the upcoming UFO office, because I think last time we spoke, it was on the Gillibrand Amendment and what could possibly happen, things coming from that. We obviously know the amendment went through with the proviso at the end of the day. We're going to have a legitimate UFO office, and in the background right now, that's getting put together. What do you know right now that's happening in the background in terms of this office, and what are your thoughts on it?
Sure. Yeah. To the best of my knowledge, the office that has been put together already, that essentially, a lot of the concerns that maybe people expressed back in November that the office that the Undersecretary for Intelligence announced abruptly before the amendment ever passed that this was going to become it, that exists, and I believe that that is going to, at this point, be the office that fulfills the requirements that were established through the legislation. Other people have told me that there is significant potential for a parallel office to be run by the Director of National Intelligence. And I think if you really get into the nitty-gritty of that bill, it absolutely ambiguously infers that that's something that's going to be needed. Because, again, going back to this bureaucracy, the DOD and ODNI are separate entities. So they're separate deals. So if you're going to work in concert with ODNI, ODNI has to have some kind of official body in place to work with. So you got to have these Lego pieces fit together. So I certainly believe that there's going to be a joint ODNI effort, but that, I believe, is still in the works. The one that the DOD has been kind of mandated is up, to the best of my knowledge. Who is running that office and who's involved in that office? I think that, you've heard some people like Christopher Mellon and Lou Elizondo express concerns about who's going to be involved with that. And I think that those concerns are founded based on what I know. I think looking at the staff summary sheet of who's involved in that office, some I know, some I don't know. And some I know have been antagonistic towards the topic. So it's kind of like, oh my God, do you want the guy who absolutely hates your football team to be your quarterback on your team, type deal. And so there's some concerns there. At the same time, it's still very early on. And I think most importantly, that Congress has really expressed, well, regardless of what it looks like right now, or regardless of the product, there's going to be expectations met by lawmakers. So I think it's still a fluid process. I think after you have your first kind of your first briefings and your first when they meet with the Armed Services Committee or the Intel's Committee and give them kind of an overview of the last 3 months or 6 months, whatever they're doing, obviously questions will be asked. It'll be interesting to see how this office changes or morphs based on is who they have in place right now currently going to produce the results that Congress wants to see.
What are some of the pros and cons of the upcoming UFO office that we're hoping to get that you can see? Is there anything you can think? Starting with the pros first, what are some of the best results that could come from it?
I think obviously the biggest pros here for that, and it was really surprising when I saw that come out, is because, and a lot of people maybe haven't really appreciated the fact that this was the first time in American history that you had Congress openly legislating the UFO topic. That's never happened before. Blue Book, you look at that. Blue Book was an eternal program started by the Air Force. They managed it themselves. They may have provided results to the public, but at no point in time were they mandated by Congress. They weren't mandated by law to do anything. They could close it whenever the heck they wanted to, which they did. Whereas in this one now, this is something that's mandated by law. So the way this system is supposed to work is that your lawmakers are elected by the people and they're supposed to express the will of the people onto the government services. And in this instance, they've expressed the will that this is a situation or issue that they want to see taken seriously. They want to see resources allocated and dedicated to this. And so for the first time, you've got a government that cannot deny or diminish how much work they're putting into it because they're legally mandated to be putting this work into it. So there is this line of accountability now. And so if they're saying, oh, we're not doing this or we're not doing that, or no, we don't take UFO reports or we don't look into them, you're like, well, then you're breaking the law. And you have your lawmakers there who are supposed to hold them accountable for that. And so I think the fact that we're seeing the UFO topic put into law and legislation, that's very, very significant. And it's very significant for what's the level of accountability and what we'll see ultimately that's produced. Cons wise, I think that they can do an absolutely expert job inside of this, and they can solve lots of mysteries, and they can hold within their grasp just irrefutable evidence that this, what this represents, you know. And if it, so long as it represents what it appears to represent currently, which is inherently a demonstration of vulnerabilities to American and other countries' national defense, that's something that is going to be inherently classified. It's going to be in here safeguarded as much as people want to believe or think that, you know, if they, especially if they knew this was something that wasn't human, that that would be immediately shared with the world and we would all, you know, this would be this great breakthrough. That's not how the defense world thinks. That's not what they're paid to do. And from them, they view it from a defense standpoint. And if they have something that they have no defense against, that's not something we're ever going to hear about. And that's, so that's very difficult. And I've always said, as long as it remains in the national security world solely, it's going to be very hard to get that that information that people really want to see out there, the information that they can show to other people and say, look, here you go. This is irrefutable evidence that I'm not crazy. What I saw is what I saw. This is not just drones, balloons, birds, and swamp gas. That's going to be a hard ticket to get out of the defense world until it's something that where they've mitigated that risk, or they have determined that it is not a risk, it's not a threat. And I'm not certain that that has I have no evidence that that has ever been achieved, that they've ever conclusively ruled out, in light of comments that they have made in public over decades, where they said, I think even the UK government, that's their stance, is much like Blue Book, that UFOs don't pose a threat to national security. Okay, cool. Well, what are they? You know, birds don't pose a threat to national security either, but I can read a book about them. So what are they? I would say that's probably that alone is probably a lie from governments when they say that it doesn't represent, not that it does represent a threat, but rather that they have conclusively determined that there isn't threat potential there. And so, yeah, it's an interesting slope as long as it remains there in the DOD. And, you know, even if the people that may be in place now, if they're antagonistic towards the UFO topic, you know, the ones I know, you trust that they're still defense professionals, they're going to handle it like defense professionals. And I think that's a concern for the public and the transparency side of things.
It's interesting, Tim, on the pros that you're saying, it's great things are getting signed into law. That's exciting. That's unprecedented. On the cons, the classified side of things, almost they start to counteract each other, don't they? Because I've had this conversation with people, including some members of the US forces, where they seem, and they're very patriotic, and I understand that, and it's easier for me, not being an American, to talk about this kind of stuff, but people lie and people circumnavigate the law. And if you're looking at a subject as incredible and as classified as UFOs or what they may or may not be, then it's not just as easy as saying, well, it's now law, so you have to tell us everything you know. And in a little while, we're going to get to talking about the US Air Force, who I'm sure know plenty of ways around those particular laws, and I'm sure already know what they can and can't do, because part of that UAP task force, they were instructed to comply and give information, and it looks like Chris Mellon's already come out and said, well, they didn't, did they? So just because it's law doesn't mean that we're going to get all that transparency we hoped for.
No. Absolutely. Highly accurate point, and you're 100% correct, especially in given that the fact that you know after saying all of this of how the defense line thinking is that this has threat potential and therefore it has to remain in the classified and top secret world, threat potential and threat are two different ball games here. One is the potential to be threatening; the other is an actual overt threat. That latter, an overt threat, there's really no evidence for that whatsoever. I mean, there's plenty of instances that I'm aware of. There's plenty of instances where, you know, the Tic Tac could have fired on Fravor and Dietrich and didn't. And, you know, so there's all these things. We certainly haven't seen War of the Worlds here. So the consequences of not being forthcoming, even when you're supposed to, and what you just mentioned, the circumventing of law and putting a half-hearted effort in it, you can certainly see people viewing those as reasonably low, because it's not like the consequences if you give half an effort into looking to counterterrorism or something like that, where you run the risk that now you're going to have some type of terrorist event and it's going to be a loss of life and it's going to be a very big deal. These are huge consequences. Whereas you view this, if I don't tell them everything, we can make this go away. The likelihood that the outcome of this is going to be catastrophic or is going to make us look bad is low. So yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's an interesting area that this extends beyond UFOs when it comes to the government, is how forthcoming is the military being with the lawmakers that they're legally supposed to be. And there's certainly an abundance of evidence to suggest that if any of the branches of military, Department of Defense wants to be, they want to obstruct things, if they want to just circumvent things for a host of reasons, they certainly will and can. They often bring up the fact that the DOD was ordered by executive order to provide an audit of their budget like 30 years ago. And still hasn't turned this thing in. So, I mean, yeah, they can shuffle things around and push things around. And especially it depends on how much of an issue does the public or lawmakers want to make it as well. I think that's, are they going to be held accountable for that kind of stuff? I think that's interesting. And I know you that was one of the things that was interesting about Chris Mellon's article that he did with us on the Air Force, is he called out appropriately instances where it seemed like people like lawmakers, like the task force, like the DOD, were allowing, why were they allowing the Air Force to circumvent things and not provide data that's being asked for? Why is this being allowed to go on? That's a very good question.
I wonder, you mentioned, what the expectations may be from this. Public hearings is something that gets brought up constantly. Is that something you think can realistically be expected to come from this in 2022? You mentioned holding people accountable. It's not something I'm necessarily concerned about myself. I don't feel that moves the conversation forward that we're all looking for to get the answers, but maybe it'll be a consequence of any kind of disclosure, if you want to call it that. But can we expect any kind of public hearings on UFOs being had?
I mean, if you were to ask my opinion right now as we see things, no, just because I don't see the political pressure that goes into it. In American politics, oftentimes, and if you think of the public hearings that most people are familiar with, public hearings go on all the time, just nobody watches C-SPAN. But the ones that capture people's attention, they're very politically motivated. It's the Russian interference election. So it's this politics, Republicans versus Democrats. Right now, it's the January 6th commission. So it's very politically motivated. When they bring big tech in and they yell at Mark Zuckerberg and the rest of them, there's big political motivations behind that. And presently, I don't see either side of the aisle viewing the UFO topic as a political issue, that they want to make the other side look bad for not taking care of that kind of thing. And it's unfortunate, because that's when we see a lot of public hearings occur. The other side of that is that Congress doesn't have the authority to declassify stuff. So going back to what I mentioned about how much, so much can be classified, so much can be guarded as state secrets, they can request hearings, they can hold public hearings that are extremely limited, perhaps very similar to essentially reading what was released in that preliminary report by ODNI last June. Reading that or the equivalent of answering that, and then therefore, even if you look at those different hearings that I mentioned earlier, you'll see public hearings, but then you'll see, after lunch, we're going to have a closed door hearing about this. So that's where the classified information is, because at the end of the day, Congress cannot tell the DOD, you need to declassify that. That actually, has to come from the president. So, you know, the authority to classify anything is through the executive privilege. And so the president is the only person who has the authority to classify anything. And again, just going into, if you ask my opinion right now, I wouldn't foresee that because there's been zero, there's been zero evidence that the current president, President Biden, has any interest in this or has made this an issue amongst his executive branches and said, look, I want an answer to this and I want it to come out for the American people. And so I don't see a lot of those parts in place. You know, those parts come in place, perhaps you will. But right now, I don't see any public hearings on the horizon.
Do you think we necessarily need those public hearings to push this conversation forward? Is there going to be a benefit to that? Or is the best way to go forward with this to try and get some of those different departments working together in some capacity? I'm going to move on shortly to talk about the US Air Force and Chris Mellon's comments, but is the best way to have people like Chris Mellon and what he seems to be doing, putting pressure on those departments? You know what? This is going to go one of two ways, and you can make it a lot easier for yourselves to cooperate, and at least that way it gives them some measure of control.
Sure. No, I do see a benefit into these public hearings, you know, especially in getting things moving forward. If for no other reason than there's been stuff that I have at times not made people too happy about behind the scenes, where I've reported on things that have been said during closed door meetings, in particularly when the director of the SAPCO, the Special Access Programs for the DOD, so the office that's in charge of all the top secret stuff, the special access programs, has testified and said that the stuff in, you know, these Nimitz videos, this is not U.S. technology. And so I think there's immense benefit for pushing the ball forward and getting a lot of people who are on the fence, who don't view this as being maybe as big a mystery as it might be, and kind of easily dismiss it as, well, yeah, maybe it's real tangible something. It's real tangible aerospace something, but it's got to be classified. I think there's huge benefit if you've got somebody like the SAPCO director, if you've got the Air Force chief who's there testifying in front of Congress, sworn in under oath, under threat of perjury and penalty of law, and he or she says, these objects that are being classified as UAP that have been observed or filmed by our service members, these are not Air Force technology. These are not DOD technology. Because then you have to make the decision, well, are they just lying under oath and committing this very public crime, when they could say, I'm not going to answer that? And so I think to that degree, you're still going to have a lot of people that would still say that, oh, it's all just their lies. It's all a big smoke and mirrors. But I think a greater majority of people are going to see that and go, huh, okay, well, we can check that one off of the list. And I think it's, it's certainly, it gives, it's nice because though we, the public, don't necessarily get to ask those follow-up questions in these hearing settings, lawmakers do. And so I'm sure a lot of us, there's a lot of questions, after the preliminary report was released, I'm sure a lot of people had a lot of questions, a lot of follow-up that we'd like. You know, they write in there, to some degree, this, to understand these UAP sightings might require a new understanding of science. Like, that's the one I think you want to raise your hand, go, wait, can we talk about that? Like, what makes you say that? And because they put it there in paper. And, I think the why would you say that is those are the questions that you get an opportunity to follow up and ask in a public hearing setting. So I certainly would be all for that. I just don't see that that potential right now.
I think for me, something that was really evident was in the build-up to the UAP Task Force report, there was a groundswell of mainstream media attention, especially from a US point of view, where you saw people like Lou, Chris, Sean Cahill, and others appearing on major networks, major breakfast shows, talk shows, not just in the US, but around the world, discussing the subject, and that has a great reaction off the back of it. We saw J.J. Abrams' UFO series, albeit disappointing in parts, it still raises the profile of the subject. Demi Lovato's series went on as well. So there was a reaction, but it was like that spike, and then it went away because the report came out, and for the mainstream, it didn't say aliens, essentially, is what it boiled down to. Although if you look into it, it didn't not say that from our point of view. So we have this then quieter period where there's less of a mainstream interest, and I think public hearings, like you say, C-SPAN, if that's a channel in the US, over in the UK, it's like there's the parliamentary channels and whatnot that are rarely watched. But if you had something like that, that certainly captures that imagination again, doesn't it, of the mainstream?
Sure. No, absolutely. I think that, and you bring up a really salient point. I'm glad you brought that up because I wasn't even thinking along those lines, which is somewhat embarrassing since I run a media company. Because definitely we had a lot more traffic when there was the UFO push because people were anxiously looking for that information every day. And so certainly whenever it's coming into the eyes and you have outlets that don't cover it very frequently. You know, some of them do infrequently, the Washington Post, Politico, the New York Times. But when you have that spread out across the land like that, and particularly when you see, because the New York Times did that before the release of the ODNI report, which I was really impressed about, is they kind of revealed what the report was going to say generally beforehand. It was very consistent with the type of reporting that they do all the time. They're very well sourced. I mean, it's a very well, it's the New York Times. And so they have great sources and everything, and they were treating it very much like they do every other national security and defense story and getting that information out there. And so, there's reams of information that assuredly could potentially come out there when you have that mainstream interest, because I'm a realist. There's people like the Times, people like the Washington Post, people have bureau chiefs in DC. It's much easier for them. I've got to work off of emails and phones where they can walk up and meet people face to face, and so there's potential information that I would love to see that come out more. I'd love to see national security reporters report on that. And so with that interest, and certainly, it's definitely one of these things, if there were public hearings announced, continued legislative action that keeps coming up, that pushes it into the mainstream eye, that pushes it into other news outlets. They push their people to push on to their sources and everything to get information. So I think there's significant benefit to it receiving more public attention, because I think for most people, and I've said this with the UFO topic in general, because I think people that have followed it or have at least become very well versed in it, and they study the history of it, and they realize this is something that has kind of been going on for decades and decades and decades. This is nothing new. From what we see now is this kind of relearning process, this rediscovery process, because there's generations of people that say post Blue Book who've kind of grown up under the impression that UFOs really, that's like, movies or sci-fi, and people maybe see a meteor and they view it more as fantasy and mythology, and don't realize that there still are these very credible sightings, and there's still these instances that defy any kind of explanation. Even for institutions like the Department of Defense, who are established to understand what's going on and flying around here, they need situational awareness. And so I think the more attention that's out there, you capture those people who rediscover this idea that, oh, wait, really? This is real? I mean, it could perhaps be likened to finding the skeletal remains of Bigfoot. Suddenly we'd all be like, wait, hold on. I just thought that was a really cool story, and we told it, and wait, that might be real. For a lot of people, I think that goes on. I mean, I've seen that from a lot of family and friends, longtime family and friends who have never really paid much attention to it, but they're, did you read this article about fast movers? I'm like, yeah, I wrote it. They're like, oh my goodness, this is real.
Roses are red, violets are blue, make sure your Tic Tacs are shiny and new. Valentine's Day is just around the corner and our sponsors at Manscaped are here for you with the best tools to get your orbs and crops ready for the special occasion. This Valentine's Day, it's time to join the 4 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped, the leaders in below-the-waist grooming. With our exclusive offer, go to manscaped.com and use promo code ANDYUFO for 20% off and free shipping. The holidays went by so quickly. Did you remember to take care of your package with the best tools for the job? The Performance Package 4.0 from Manscaped is just the thing every guy needs in their life to make each and every day a little bit more special. The number one product in this package, as always, is the Lawnmower 4.0. This electric safe trimmer is designed to trim hair on loose skin. And get this, the trimmer's advanced skin-safe technology reduces cuts and nicks on your delicate orbs. It even has a 4000K LED spotlight that would put the Phoenix lights to shame. Did I mention it's waterproof too? Transmedium travel is no problem for this secret tech. The package also includes the weed whacker, and two free gifts are thrown in as well, their shed travel bag and anti-chafing boxers to help keep your boys stored comfortably. Ideal for travelling to South America to film documentaries on the phenomena. Who knows? Anyway, folks, go to manscaped.com for our exclusive offer of 20% off and free shipping with the code ANDYUFO. Get something for yourself this Valentine's Day. Support Manscaped. Support the podcast. Thank you very much.
You mentioned, Tim, about an increase in site traffic, and I'm sure one thing that will do that for you is an article by Christopher Mellon, which has recently been published on the Debrief website. The article is titled, "Why is the Air Force AWOL on the UAP issue?" The link for that will be in the description if you haven't read it already. It's fantastic, and as much detail as there is in there, it's an interesting read, even if you're not well versed on the US military. Christopher Mellon does a very good job in explaining what he's talking about within that. Early on in the article, Chris talks about various different satellite systems that are unclassified that he can talk about. And I'm going to just read you a small piece that he writes after he's listed many of these different programs or satellites, and different weapons, sensors and such. How is this possible in light of the US Air Force's global responsibility for aerospace defense and its massive air and space surveillance capabilities? Are we to believe that the US Air Force did not detect any UAPs from 2004 until 2021? This lapse in US Air Force reporting raises doubts about the credibility of the Air Force on the UAP issue and its responsiveness to civilian oversight. Is Chris Mellon essentially at that point calling out the US Air Force?
Yeah, no, first of all, you know, big kudos to Chris. You know, Chris authored that entire article and put all that work into it. And he mentioned working on this months ago and mentioned it was something that he wanted to do and would be interested in publishing it. And so absolutely, you know, it's definitely interesting. And big kudos to Micah Hanks, who was the editor of that. You know, a lot of work. Editors never get any good credit, but they put significant amount of work into it. And it's at the end of the day, it's Micah who makes that decision that we included all of that information. That was one of the things I was very happy that we were able to publish it, because I know just from experience and working with other outlets, you know, it was like an 8,500 word article, almost 9,000 word article. There's not many outlets that are going to let that go. But I felt like everything that he put in there and even laying out all of these capabilities, and it was good. It was good information. It's good information people don't realize, but it makes that point that his overarching point that it's virtually impossible that the Air Force would not be detecting this stuff. It is virtually impossible that they would not have more information on this, because they're the branch of the service that is supposed to be equipped to handle this. And their silence for the last 4 years on this has been deafening. It has been mystifying. You know, I share in some of his sentiments of being flabbergasted that you haven't had anything coming out of the Air Force, period. And I certainly haven't come across some of the information that he shared in that article directly. So, you know, he mentioned the fact that Air Force pilots and officers and airmen were had, you know, had been warned and threatened. Don't talk to people. Don't do this. Don't do that. I hadn't heard that directly, but that makes perfect sense because, you know, I've had the opportunity to talk to a lot of people from a lot of different branches. And, you know, there are people who reach out to me and contact me. The Air Force is one that zero, you know, nobody whatsoever, nothing, absolute silence. And so that certainly makes sense. And I think he's spot on in saying that it is incredible that this is the branch with the biggest capabilities of it. And frankly, if we're talking about this topic, should have the most vested interest in it. A has been totally silent and B has been allowed to be totally silent on it. And I wish I had a good explanation for that.
Yeah. I mean, when you read the article, it certainly comes across like Chris is very much tongue-in-cheek, you know, telling the US Air Force, you know, you're lying about this. And it's almost like when you talk to a child that you know they're lying. Well, I can't believe that you didn't do this when you know for a fact. And I'm sure that's probably a good place to come from with this. I want to ask you, though, Tim, two scenarios. Which do you lean more towards? Scenario one, the US Air Force know nothing and can't say, I don't know about this subject, and they won't admit their failing in their duty. Or scenario number two, they know everything and they're keeping us in the dark.
Could I go with like a scenario three, which is they know much more and keeping us in the dark? I don't.
Yeah, okay.
I won't go all the way out and say they know everything because I don't know that. But I certainly do believe that they know considerably more than they have, than they're letting on, or that they would like to lead people to believe. And I think, Chris, you're right. You know, that scolding kind of approach, he's accurate in that, come on, you know, you know, you're going to tell me you don't know anything? That's BS. You know, how does the Navy know something? How does the Coast Guard know something? How do these other people know something? You don't know nothing? There's no way. And so there certainly is at least enough there, a kind of abductive logic using with the information we do know to say that the Air Force knows a lot more than they're letting on. And so the question really, I guess the biggest question here is why? And so when I say that I don't know that, that's the part that is mysterious. But I certainly think there's other components. I know that there's other components within government who know more about this particular subject. They know more about UAP. They've either encountered it or collected data at times inadvertently. So, you know, they're doing something totally different. They're like, oh, man, we just picked this up. I know there are other components that exist that have existed, and that information exists outside of the cogs in the wheel. They're outside of what ATIP or OSAP or even the task force worked on. You know, that was maybe you'll ask me about this. Maybe it's a viewer question. I'm surprised if it wasn't, because I'd mentioned a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, about anti-neutrinos. You know, people were talking about this idea of luring UAP in, and I just kind of mentioned, the anti-neutrino study done by the geospatial intelligence might be a good idea. And that comes from information that comes from outside of the ATIP purview, let's say. So the Elizondo and the, the Bass people, maybe the usual suspects, let's say that comes out of that. It comes out of it far enough that, I have on background or behind the scenes asked some of those guys. I've asked Elizondo about does anti-neutrinos play into it? And he seemed to legitimately, express that it wasn't something that was involved in what they were doing at ATIP and everything. So I know there is other evidence that comes out. There's other things that come out. And so it's the Air Force becomes the most obscene that's being silent, but they're not by a long shot the only one that is being silent.
And antineutrinos, for anyone wondering why I'm not following that up straight away, is part of the conversation, but I'll get to that in just a few minutes. I moved that around a little bit because I felt it was best to go into Chris's article at the moment. Something else Chris mentioned was that many unclassified systems the Air Force has at its disposal. In particular, he talks about systems that can track ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, aimed at the United States. And he asks again, did none of these pick up the objects from the 2004 Nimitz event? If these had picked them up, Tim, and the US Air Force with these systems were aware of the Nimitz event, which, remember, happened over, 7 to 10 days? It wasn't a Fravor encountered something and that was it. It happened over a week. What do you think the Air Force was doing with this data as they get it? Simply observing? Are they monitoring? Or are they turning off the monitors and looking the other way?
You know, I wish that I had a good answer for that. And I go back and forth on my personal opinion of it, from thinking that either there is significant just naivety, or there's just, I've often called it just, willfully oblivion, a willful apathy towards it, where it's kind of just look the other way and pretend it's not there. Whether that's institutionalized, it's just kind of the culture in the organization type thing. To some degree, I think you're going to see some of that. And so, you can pick up something. It's like, I have been told that is not real. I will keep looking the other way. I think that's true. But then I go back and forth and going, well, what are they doing? It goes back into something we talked about early on about how do you handle big secrets, and especially how do you handle a big secret that you view as being completely vulnerable to and defenseless to when your business is defense. How do you manage that secret? How do you handle that? Does the potential exist out there that the Air Force or some kind of carve out of it, recognizes that these things are real events, recognizes that this is persistently going on, but views it in that they're defenseless to it, and frankly doesn't know what it is doing? Why, so now we're acting on the hypothesis that this is inhuman or this is something other. What is it doing? And if you can't answer that, from a defense perspective, you start doing the checklist. I know a lot of people think, well, it's here to make us peace, love, and happy, and they're here so we don't blow each other with nuclear weapons. They really didn't do anything. They haven't stopped that. They certainly didn't stop us when we, killed thousands of innocent people with a nuclear weapon, and they haven't stopped when we've destroyed our environment by testing them all the time. So that doesn't seem, there's no evidence for that. So what are they doing? And so is this idea, does the potential exist? Can you conclusively rule and take it off the table that this is not something that's doing pre-battlefield intelligence? The same thing we do before you go into war. You make sure you got everything about the terrain, everything about the combatants, everything that you can about it before you go engage in a conflict. Is that what's going on? There's no evidence for that either. But at the same time, if you don't know what's going on, is it something that you can completely remove off the table? I would say no. And so just based on that alone, do you engage in this kind of long running systemic secrecy? Maybe. It's as long as it's an unknown, I think it would be reckless for anybody to outwardly say what is or isn't true, at least in the parameters of plausibility, if that makes sense.
We hear about so many things within organizations where at the highest level, something untoward has been going on. Maybe it's been, systematic bullying or whatever it may be. There's so many things. But if you're directly below that level, that you can't influence what happens, but for your own sake and for your own role and job, you allow it to happen, you ignore it. There's that possibility that's what's happening here with the Air Force, in the sense that we know there's something, we can't do anything about it. It massively weakens us and makes us look poor. So what we can do is just turn the other cheek and let it go on until it does directly affect us.
Sure. No, absolutely. You know, down to the fact that I think I've said that out of all of the idea of there being crashed UFO recoveries, Roswell being real, the most plausible scenario I ever heard was, and it was one I never considered before, was this idea that, yes, something could have crashed. Let's say Roswell. Yes, something could have been recovered, but its technology was so far beyond our understanding that we simply couldn't figure it out. And so you're looking at it from the perspective of, I could spend my entire defense budget trying to figure this out, and I'm still not going to be any closer than I was beforehand. And meanwhile, life goes on. The world goes on. You've got, if you put it in modern perspective, you've got this potential and threat of war in Ukraine right now between Russia. There's a lot of tension in geopolitics, and you realize if I dump my whole defense budget into figuring this out and am no closer, meanwhile, my potential near-peer adversaries, Russia, China, they're building bombs, they're building planes, they're building aircraft carriers that can be used against me. So I'm actually going to put myself in a more vulnerable position. So we're just going to box that up. We're going to put it in the archives, like Raiders of the Lost Ark. And we're going to check, every how many ever decades and try to see, where are we? Where is our science? Where is our level of understanding? And are we at a position now where we can better understand this or make use of it? If we're not, we're going to box it back up. That doesn't sound crazy to me. maybe people would think that, the Air Force or the government or whoever would run out and, look at this alien body, everybody. I'm not so sure, especially if you don't know anything. If you're like, I don't know who this is, what this is, and what the intent is. That's a scary position to be in, especially when you're talking about governments and institutions built on public faith, trust. We put considerable faith and trust into our governments to care for our welfare. And if they come out and say, that's crazy, guys. We ain't got a clue here. I think it, even if it's implicitly, it erodes our faith in that government. We're less likely to put faith in government then. And so the scenario you presented there, I think it is very plausible. I mean, I know it is, because that's in interviews that when I spoke to people like former Secretary of the Navy, Ray Mabus, I asked him, when he told me, yeah, this stuff happens. They have these weird sightings. He knew about the Roosevelt. He knew about these incidents. And he's like, the military folks just never really gave an explanation. They were just, yeah, we don't know. And I was like, did you never want to follow up on that? Did you never say, well, damn it, no, you're going to find out. And he was like, my bandwidth for stuff that I had to deal with was limited. And you've got so much going on. When I talked to the advisors for this Secretary of Defense Mattis, who had been briefed by Lou Elizondo, and they legitimately were like, no, I trust the information they were saying was real. This is not some big LARP or whatever. They're like, no, this really happened inside professional settings, inside real official areas. And they were like, but man, we had so much going on at the time. And the UFOs weren't attacking us, and they weren't posing a risk, whereas we did have real world risk that we had to mitigate. And so, yeah, I think that scenario absolutely exists.
That Roswell scenario of having the technology crash that you have no idea where to even begin, it reminds me of that advert that went viral a few years ago where a daughter buys our elderly father, I think it is, like an iPad, but he doesn't know what the iPad is for. And she turns around in the kitchen one day and he's using it as a chopping board, and he takes the vegetables off it and rinses it under the sink, and he's like, oh, this is great for this use. And is that where we were potentially at when this saucer crashes, if that's what it was? And we look and go, where's the control panels? Where's the exhaust? Where's the windows? Where's the door? There isn't any. Let's just put it away in a box, and like you say, we'll Indiana Jones for it when it's in an archive somewhere.
And you can't spend the amount of effort and time into figuring something like that out without, you can keep that out of the public's eyes pretty well, but you can't keep that out of your adversary's eyes. And I've used the example of the atomic bomb. here is the most destructive weapon that has ever been known by mankind. So destructive that full-scale nuclear war amongst countries could end the world. We could cause our own extinction. So there's not really anything we can know of and can think of that should be more controlled or that you wouldn't want potential adversaries possessing. But yet, if you look at the atomic weapon, the Russians were already had already been able to steal atomic secrets and kind of had an idea of the bomb being built before it was ever dropped, before going back a year, before 1945. And so it wasn't long after before we saw the Soviet Union has their own nuclear weapons. And now you have all this. And so, yeah, when you put that much effort into it, you've also got to recognize that you're going, the potential is that somebody else figures it out first. And, are they going to weaponize it, this type of thing? There's a lot of things that I imagine go through defense leaders' minds in a scenario like that.
I'm curious on your thoughts, Tim. Chris Mellon repeatedly goes back to, in any of his conversations or on the news, on documentaries and talking head pieces and articles, the possibility of some of these objects being of an extraterrestrial origin. However, Lou Elizondo, more and more, seems to talk about objects of non-human origin being potentially from other dimensions, other realities, potentially being based here, based on Earth, somewhere in some way, shape or form. Is this deliberate, do you think, that they both go down these routes, but they both seem to have obviously alternative views on what this could be?
Sure. And I definitely don't want to speak on behalf of Chris or Lou, but I think that that's very common, not just with them, but any of the major players, you might say. So any of the well-known people, Gary Nolan, Eric Davis, these people, I think when they're certainly past the point where they believe that these events are real, that these objects are real, that these are real, something's really going on. But what that really represents, I think I know a lot of people believe that that's not true. That the government or somebody, whether it's MJ-12 or whatever, knows everything. They've made the secret treaty with the Greys and all of this. But I think, when you look at the fact that when we get to, well, what exactly does this represent, that we see differences of opinion in people like Lou and Chris, I think that really demonstrates that, no, I don't know that we're there. I don't know that anybody has that final answer. This is what it is. This is where it comes from. This is how it does what it does. I don't know that anyone has that. And so it leaves into this last, what is the most plausible or what theory do you believe is most likely? And so, I think for Chris, based on his comments, that would be extraterrestrial. Lou, maybe it's something other than extraterrestrial. I think it's, at the same time, I think all of the terms they've used are kind of synonymous because if it's not human and it's not, then it's extraterrestrial and it's not us. It's all one and the same. Even if it was interdimensionals, I think we could make the point, well, that's still alien. They're still coming from an alien land. I wouldn't say, I've never got the feeling that represents that one of them or any one person's kind of conclusion to what it is more correct than the other.
Tim, you caused a little bit of a Twitter stir or storm when you dropped in, like you mentioned earlier. It was a bit of a thread that was going on talking about UEP baiting and how these things may be attracted. And I think you dropped in a little bomb of perhaps a good place to start in tying in some of the threads of UFO coaxing would be to look into the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency's 2015 global mapping of antineutrinos. I mean, that rolls off the tongue, and if you're just pulling that one straight off the top of your head, that's amazing. For folks who don't know, what's an antineutrino?
Sure. Antineutrino is just a byproduct of a neutrino. So it's the opposite of a neutrino. And in the context that I was kind of mentioning it, I mean, you have antineutrinos in anything that you have radiation. So you've got radiation, you've got both neutrinos and then antineutrinos, but then they're also a byproduct of radioactive processes, like nuclear reactors. So nuclear submarines or nuclear bombs, that type of thing. And anything that's nuclear like that, anything that's radioactive is going to likewise give off neutrinos and antineutrinos. And so, That is my very rudimentary definition there, because I will caveat I'm not a physicist.
People like me definitely appreciate that. Now, that 2015 map shows reactors, large potassium deposits, all things that we hear may potentially attract UAP. I would ask, would nuclear-powered Navy fleets also give off antineutrinos?
Sure, yeah, and that's the idea of detecting antineutrinos has been something that has been really on the forefront and on the cutting edge of the defense research world's mind for a number of years, you know, let's say the last 10 years, because the potential exists for both intelligence purposes, nuclear proliferation. You know, it's a byproduct of you know, developing. If you develop a nuclear bomb, you're going to be giving off antineutrinos, and so the ability to detect that at range and over the horizon is a huge capability, because now you have an idea of, has Iran developed a nuclear weapon? We now know. In addition to the fact that she mentioned with nuclear submarines, if you can detect that, because the object for these subs, and they continue to get quiet, more quiet and quiet, and these stealth subs, it becomes harder to detect subs by our traditional means. And so this idea that you could detect antineutrinos, not only would you be able to detect those subs, you could basically follow them around, from afar, from your satellites. And so there's been a significant amount of work, not published, very limitedly published work on the idea of trying to track down antineutrinos or developing devices that can detect and track antineutrinos in the defense world, and really kind of hitting its peak around that 2015-16 timeframe when geospatial intelligence did their neutrino mapping.
Where do you sit, and what have you heard, Tim, on the Navy or otherwise using potentially nuclear materials, for lack of a better term, to attract or bait or coax UAPs?
I have heard that, and I think I published that in an article that, that I have been told that the use of nuclear assets to attract or bait them. Now, whether that is by intentional operational plan, meaning that, hey, we're going to bring out all these nuclear assets and bait them in, or whether it is, hey, we've got a lot of nuclear assets already going out to do workups or whatever, let's go out with our detectors and see what we can find. I don't know that. But I do know that the idea of using the potential for nuclear powered defense devices, aircraft carriers, submarines to enhance your ability to capture UAP. I know that's something that several people have said, going back into the ATIP days when Lou Elizondo was there, that was something that was definitely looked into and exercised. When I mentioned this antineutrino mapping, that's why I'm glad you brought it up. That's why I jumped into it early, in fact, is because it's hard to convey exactly what I'm trying to say when I just throw something out there on Twitter, especially when in this instance, you're kind of like, hey, it'd be great if some of you guys, I'm crowdsourcing intelligence work there. I'm crowdsourcing. Hey, can you guys help look into this some more too? Because I haven't had the time to effectively really dive into it. But it came from, early on. And I say that, that was stuff that came from outside of the ATIP crew or the usual suspects crew, but just in early days of me looking at this subject and leaning on people that I knew and trusted and had known and had close relationships for a long time and saying, so what do you know about this? What do you think about this? And this, the idea of a little more than, you should check out some of the antineutrino stuff that's going on, or what maybe was picked up during some of the antineutrino surveys, that kind of thing. And so it got me very interested in it. But that's a difficult thing to dive too much into because it is a very highly classified area. And then that kind of idea that antineutrinos could play a part of it was actually only exacerbated a few years ago when a very close, good friend of mine who is also a journalist who also is not a UFO journalists by any means. They have written on the topic some, but they're a very well-respected, well-known national security defense reporter, and somebody that I know firsthand is, you know, really just exceptionally sourced in that world. And they brought that up to me out of the blue. You know, it was like, what do you think about this, Andy? And I went, holy cow, you're the second person I've ever heard that. And both of us were hearing that from sources that would have been in similar kind of arenas. And I felt like we're really solid individuals. And so how the anti-neutrino thing goes into it, I don't have a good answer for that. When I brought it up in the context of how would you use that for baiting, it was more, you know, you take back the, you pull back a little bit and take the 50,000 foot overview of everything first and say, okay, if I am going to engage and believe and assume that this is something that can be baited, then I am acting on the assumption or the knowledge that this is a persistent, something. This is something that's persistent rather than just transient. You know, you're not going to go fishing in a pond that, you know, fish occasionally swim through maybe once a year, but rather the one that you know that there's going to be fish there. That's when you're going to bait it and try to catch fish. And so that 50,000 foot view is you have to understand that if they're going to bait it, the assumption that this is a persistent thing is already there. On top of the fact that you have some type of intelligence that you know where to put those bait traps out at. You know, you have been able to narrow down areas of interest. You know what ponds are stocked and have the big fish. And so,
for example, the Catalina Islands is rumored heavily to be one of those places.
Right. You know, you've got a lot of these stories from off the East Coast now. And absolutely, you know, right there in that Southern California range area, you've got these lots of accounts. So these would be areas where you would say, okay, that's a good spot to do it. The interesting thing with the geospatial anti-neutrino map is that's a global map. So you have this global widespread overview of it. And that opens up a whole new potential that if you're going to bait something like this and you want to do it covertly, I'm not going to bait it off of Catalina Island because it's probably going to show up on, you and I are going to be talking about that cool YouTube video of the UFO that people captured because we baited it out. But if there's perhaps areas where there are hot spots that are very remote, I mean, especially when we're talking about the Navy and we're talking about the oceans, you know, the Earth is far more covered by the oceans. And so if you've got remote areas and that you know are good, quote, fishing holes, and could this be potentially achieved by looking at that anti-neutrino map where you're identifying, you have anti-neutrino, you're getting anti-neutrinos, you're detecting them in areas where there shouldn't be. And now, in terms of that, I'm not entirely sure that, you know, to save some people some time of like looking at the anti-neutrino map pixel by pixel, I'm not sure that that's granular enough. You know, you would have to really maybe get into the real data of that to where you could pick up that type of stuff. But that's what I was getting at when I mentioned that, is that I do think that there's some type of anti-neutrino component to this. How that exactly factors in, I'm still not clear on. It's crowdsourcing. I was hoping UFO Twitter has an amazing ability to to solve all sorts of mysteries when they put their mind to it.
That is all for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. Please remember to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. You can like, retweet, and subscribe. That would all be very much appreciated. The shows are being uploaded onto YouTube as we speak more and more. You can sign up at patreon.com/thatufopodcast to access the shows ad-free as well. Please get in touch on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, thatufopodcast. Of course, on Twitter, it's @UFOUAPAM. And again, folks, as always, keep looking up. You never know what you might see.
It wasn't a tic-tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer. A little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right outside of my window, and when I shut out the screen, he made it an issue. I don't think he expected me to see his ass, but I'd had some champagne and smoked a little bit. Meditated game of fateful on meta. Can't imagine how it could have been any better. I got to the top of the stairs and there he was. Like, you awake? I was about to abduct you, cuz. I jumped back and nearly kissed myself. Then I climbed out the window after the elf. And I woke up in my bed and there was something on my head. And everything was weird and everything was red. I called up my boys. They thought this was noise. They thought it was a dream. They thought it was my toys. They thought it was my problems. And they think I should seek therapy. And I don't know what it is because it doesn't really scare me. If you really want to know who I think they'd be, then it's you and me and us and we and him and her and that and she and that thing over there and what's that, Jane? But for being serious, open your mind, consider your heart, consider time, consider your space, consider your lies, consider your life, consider your eyes.
Morgan Sweet Chili Lime is so delicious, so unbelievable, no word exists to describe it. It's better than mind-blowing, it's mouth-blowing. Bright, citrusy, and spicy, this newest flavor from Captain Morgan is a balanced blend of sweetness with delicious notes of lime and slightly spicy chili flavor that is great for an escape outdoors with your crew or your next hangout. Captain Morgan Sweet Chili Lime is best enjoyed as an ice-cold shot or as a chili lime twist on a classic as a spicy daiquiri. Captain Morgan Sweet Chili Lime, a touch of sweet, a kick of heat. Please drink responsibly. Captain Morgan Sweet Chili Lime, premium Caribbean rum with natural flavors, 35% alcohol by volume, Captain Morgan Rum Co., New York, New York. Captain Morgan Sweet Chili Lime is so delicious, so unbelievable, no word exists to describe it. It's better than mind-blowing, it's mouth-blowing. Bright, citrusy, and spicy, this newest flavor from Captain Morgan is a balanced blend of sweetness with delicious notes of lime and slightly spicy chili flavor that is great for an escape outdoors with your crew or your next hangout. Captain Morgan Sweet Chili Lime is best enjoyed as an ice-cold shot or as a chili lime twist on a classic as a spicy daiquiri. Captain Morgan Sweet Chili Lime, a touch of sweet, a kick of heat. Please drink responsibly. Captain Morgan Sweet Chili Lime, premium Caribbean rum with natural flavors, 35% alcohol by volume, Captain Morgan Rum Co., New York, New York.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.